Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is February the 19th, 2026. It is a Thursday. And here's something I really haven't given you this much, very much this year yet. TikTok. TikTok. The clock ticks for us all. We are halfway, actually more than halfway, through February. Many of you, like me, are going to be setting out your plants in your gardens, if you're a gardener, in about a month. I mean, mid-March is pretty standard here, with a cursory look at the weather to make sure there's not some front in the next 10 days coming in. If you're going to make it to April 1, you're probably good down here. But another way for you business-minded people, you're more than halfway through the first quarter of the new year. Huh? You get it? You get it yet? Those of you like me, born in the last century, doesn't that piss you all day? Well, you're from the latter part of the last century. Huh, I guess I am. Think about the fact once in a while. Just think about this fact. From right now back to 1980 is the same temporal distance of 1980 back to 1936. Pissed off yet? Well, I just tell you, the days are long, but the years are short. You have a finite amount of time on this earth. You have a dash that you were given. That's your length of life. And it gets a little shorter every day. Tick tock, tick tock. The clock ticks for us all. You're either moving forward in your journey of liberty, independence, wealth creation, and lifestyle design, or by trying to just be static and stay still, life is pushing you back. Now, we've got a great setup of experts today to talk about different ways to reclaim more sovereignty in your life. Some of the stuff we have today is about mental sovereignty. Whenever we talk about politics, it ain't because we think we're going to change it. It's so that we understand what's going on, and we can adapt to it and then build our own lives in spite of it. We're going to be talking about making shagbark hickory syrup, something I said we would do last week, but apparently I brain farted and missed it. That's about food stability. Being able to take a resource other people see mostly as trash and turn it into something decadent. Nick Ferguson's going to talk about handing out and storing fodder for livestock feed, and that's about real independence. Not only are you independent from the food system, you're independent from the feed store. Ryan Steve is going to do some more follow-up on water systems in response to my follow-up on his original segment on water systems. Matt Powers had asked back at the beginning of last month, for sizing ideas and all, to use solar to back up a well so he'd have water during a long-term power outage. I came up with some other ideas for how that could be done other than just with solar. And then Ryan listened to that. He's going to take that further. I'm going to say again, I love this. I love this. And I want to see more of it between expert council members. If you're an expert council member and somebody says something and you want to add to it or bring up some other components to it, please do. And I'll even throw this out as like an open invitation. If you're out there and you're really knowledgeable on a subject and an expert council member speaks on it, you're like, man, if I was there, I would say like this 5 to 7 minutes on it of additional things, record it and send it to me. I will not guarantee you that it will end up on the air, but if it's good, it will. You don't have to be an expert council member to be on an expert council show. I just had a question come in today on mushrooms. I sent it to Olga Kadic, and we'll see if she wants to answer it. And I told her you can either answer it as a one-off or I'm open to bringing you on the council. And I'm waiting to hear back from her if she's going to answer it or not, or if I get somebody else to do it. And honestly, the question I got, I could answer. But I was like, hey, that would be cool. And I do that from time to time. You know, I'll have somebody on, like, I've used Matt Hill a couple times from Start 9. He's not on the council. He doesn't want to dedicate the time to it. I don't think I'd have enough questions for him. But when somebody comes in that's, you know, in that digital sovereignty arena, he's the guy I know with the most information, so I'll get him to do a one-off. So it's, you can always volunteer a one-off. I don't know if I've ever said that, but it's happened time to time, and I should encourage it. But I also want more of my community, my expert panel community, bouncing things off each other. And if you want to pregame it and talk to each other backside, go ahead. And if you just want to throw it out there, just throw it out there. We're all big boys and girls here. Next up today, Jesse Markowitz will talk about a pass key versus a password and why you might want to use one. Joel Riles is going to talk about dealing with a dog that's like well-behaved like 90% of the time, but when it's not well-behaved, it's always the time when you really need it to be well-behaved. And now this family has a new baby that's going to be coming home from the hospital soon. I guess they don't have the baby yet, or it would already be there, but they're going to be bringing a new baby home, and then they're worried about this dog. And Joel's got some thoughts on that. I always have follow-up on dog things because I love dogs. And then I'll have a really short segment, and maybe we can, some of us in the audience can work together on this. Somebody sent me yesterday a really great email of a link to a video on YouTube of a dude crushing biochar. And I've seen about a bazillion ways to crush biochar. None of them are great. The way I gave you guys last week with driving over it and putting it through the screens is the best I had found up till now. And again, as I said, the way I do it, it sounds pretty laborious. It's really not hard. I mean, I'll do a batch in about an hour, and that includes drinking two beers and farting around while I'm doing it. But this looks a lot better. And he goes through all the ways I've tried and all the ways I've considered and decided not to try and all the ways that maybe work, but they're really, really, really expensive, and it's beyond what I need for backyard biochar. He uses a fruit crusher. Not a fruit squeezer, not like a juicer, a crusher. This is a machine. It's got kind of a funnel-shaped top. You dump whatever you're going to crush into it, and you turn a crank, or you can hook up a motor to it, or some of them come with motors, and there's these kind of like metal fingers that pull things down and break them up. It looks like, if you've ever seen one of the great big machines they used to like shred cars in a junkyard, it looks like a little mini version of that. When we get to my segment, I'll tell you why I think it's actually really a brilliant design for biochar crushing, and it probably ain't because of what you think. But I'm thinking of picking one of these up. They run about $100. Some of them are less, some of them are more. Some of them come with a motor, some of them don't. I'm not sure on sizing because somebody says they're all 7 liters, but some of them say they're 4 liters, and the 4 liter ones look like a 7 liter. I don't know. But I'll go through some of my ideas on this, and maybe some of y'all might reach out, and maybe this would be like a group community project where we can all play around with it and figure out what the best way to go forward with it is, because this is what I believe. I know there's people out there with metal shops and welding shops and everything, and anything you can think of can be made. Here's the reality about biochar right now, though. It's not a big enough niche for a product like that to be able to be put into production at such a level that its cost of production can be driven down to be practical for the market. Right? A person who is going to make, you know, biochar 4 or 5 times a year, you know, maybe they're using a 50-gallon drum, or they're using a couple Weber kettle grills, or using a pit or whatever, and they're just all the prunings and all the slash and all the shit off their property, they're turning it into char, can't logistically afford and can't make a financial case for spending $2,000, $3,000 on a crusher. It's just one piece of the total. It doesn't make any sense. $100? Yeah. So we're going to need something off the shelf. That's where I'm coming at with this, and when I get to my segment, we'll talk about it. Before we do, I want to remind you guys, one of the ways you can help support this show is do your online shopping where? You know where. tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z. tspaz.com. And the item of the day today is the same item of the day I had for you yesterday. I just think it's a fantastic item. A bunch of you picked some up yesterday. I'm encouraging you to pick them up today. It is one of the best things for basic preparedness in your home you can do for yourself. It is power failure lights, and in this case, it's made by Energizer. These things, they plug into the wall, and they charge constantly. You can set them so that when it's dark, they come on like a nightlight, or they don't. You can also, when the power goes out, though, they automatically turn on. So you plug them into an outlet that all it has power to it, and you just leave it there and forget about it, basically. Now you have a power outage when you're taking a shower and your kids are crying and all kinds of other bullshit's going on. All of them you have set throughout the house just turn on. You can see where you're going. So when you get out of the shower with soap in your face and your kids screaming in the other room and you got a towel wrapped around you, you don't bust the shit out of yourself and hurt yourself. You just pull it out of the wall and walk around with like a flashlight till you get your life back together. You can get a set of 3 of them for about $50. I recommend most homes will do well with $250 packs. So it's $100 to have redundant lighting throughout your entire house. And it will work, and they just work. And they solve a problem as to why I stopped talking about this particular technology years ago. When I first found things that did this, I thought this was one of the smartest things we could have in our home. all of them had completely sealed up bodies, internal rechargeable batteries you couldn't swap out, and all of them eventually kind of cooked off to the point where the light would come on and never go off. And then it wasn't bright enough to really work. They wouldn't take a charge. They just kind of would stay on for about 5 minutes after you pulled them out, and then they would die. And there's nothing you could do but throw them away and buy another set. You know, at $50 a piece, you're looking at about $16 a unit. You don't want to be throwing them away every 2 years. Let me tell you what they did with these. It's brilliant. They use standard rechargeable batteries. If I remember right, they're AAA. They're triple or double A. Okay? Standard ones you can buy anywhere. There's four screws. You take four screws out, pop the batteries out, put new batteries in, plug it back in, and go on with your life. Doesn't that seem like a better solution? Something that's maintainable by the user. These are becoming rare. I don't mean these things. I mean things that are maintainable by the user are becoming more and more rare and designed out. It's good to see a major brand actually bring it back. Now, whether it was intentional or not, I don't know. But it's that easy to do. I just recommend that you put it on a maintenance schedule once every 2 years, swap your batteries, and your backup lighting system will be flawless for you. Pair this with some LED lanterns and a full blackout kit, and then maybe some inverters for your vehicle or a proper generator, and you'll weather blackouts just a lot better. And again, something that instantly works without you doing anything for this low price that saves you the frantic nonsense of dealing with chaos is totally worth it. And again, you guys that have some younger kids, man, do you want these in so many ways. With that, let's go ahead and jump on into it. Let's start off. We're going to hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams today answering for them a question for themselves, right? Why is a senior U.S. senator in Israel once every 2 weeks? Of course, we're talking about Lindsey Graham, who is probably the person on the Republican side of the aisle in the Senate that I actually loathe the most. I don't understand how Trump makes this sleazebag an ally. I think personally, just looking at him, he looks like a pedo to me. If he's not in the Epstein files, I'll be shocked. He's definitely a sellout, and I just consider him to be a piece of crap. But I think we do need to have a broader discussion about Israel, because there's a problem with that discussion, and it is by design. It is either Israel is responsible for everything in the Jews, right, and just total psycho out on that side, or complete denialism. And the reality is Judaism is a religion. Israel is a religious nation under the flag of Judaism. Those are two different things. I can criticize the nation without necessarily criticizing people of faith within that religion. And if we can't criticize a nation, we are in a bad situation. And guess what? We're not allowed to criticize that nation. Try it and see what happens to you, especially if you are any level of prominent individual where people actually listen to you. Ever notice that people don't get mad at what people say? People get mad at what people say only when other people listen. And the more people that listen, the madder they get. With that in mind, let's hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on this particular issue with our favorite buddy, Lindsey Graham.
Thumbs up from everyone. Okay. Well, I'm Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. I'm back. I come here every 2 weeks whether I need to or not.
So what is a senator from South Carolina? Why is he going to Israel every 2 weeks? So anyway, so here's the article. Put this up, and we're going to play a couple of clips because Senator Graham did a press conference, as you said, Dr. Paul, in Israel, of course. It's not good enough for him just to be put on that go back one if you can. It's not enough for him to be on every single Sunday show. He also has to go to Israel and grab the microphone. But here it is from Dave DeCamp. From Israel, Senator Graham pushes for war on Iran while admitting troops can be hit. Let's listen to that first video. Now, we did talk about this yesterday, but after our show, this quote went viral. This clip went viral. Everyone was talking about this, and we're disgusted about him saying, yeah, they're going to get killed, so what? Let's play it on that first video. Here we go.
And absolutely, they could. Can Iran respond if we have an all-out attack? Absolutely, they can. I think the risk associated with that is far less than the risk associated with blinking and pulling the plug and not helping the people as you promised.
Okay, that's enough for that one. Imagine going over to a foreign country and saying that American soldiers are going to get killed in this, but we think the risk is worth it. It's better than backing down. It's all, war for him is always better than diplomacy, you know.
It doesn't look good as far as I'm concerned. There's lots of threats, and if we do what we threaten, and it seems like the president's going along with all this, that the bombs will fall, and if one goes astray and hits Tehran, watch out. So yeah. I think it's not a good mood. It's moving us closer to a much bigger war.
They weren't always buddies. In fact, here's what he had to say about Trump when Trump ran the first time. This is Lindsey Graham, Senator Graham, Trump's best buddy. He said, "You know how to make America great again? Tell Donald Trump to go to hell. He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot. He doesn't represent my party. He doesn't represent the values that men and women who wear the uniform are fighting for. He's the ISIS man of the year." This is what he said. And now they're hanging out.
A little hypocrisy there.
There's a lot going on because he knows he can cajole Trump. Remember, he calls him, that's why I was joking earlier, he calls him, you're Reagan plus, you know, trying to get him to go to war. And that's what he's doing. He's just joking him. But he said that's just a minor of what the stuff he was saying before about Trump. So he hated Trump until he decided he could use Trump or try to use Trump.
I'll let what they said speak for itself. My add-on here, though, is this. Why did Lindsey Graham go from being a never-Trumper, basically, to all in on the Trump train? And they're right on some levels that it benefits him to do so, like kiss the ring of the king that's currently on the throne if you want to get things done. But there's another, how do we go from that animosity and full-on, like, hate to this? Well, I'm going to invoke another name that most of you will probably despise, Nikki Haley. Remember when Vivek Ramaswamy, during the debate, said that she'll send your kids to war so she can buy a bigger house? That was a zinger, and the reason it stung is because the track record showed that the statement was factual. That's why. Lindsey Graham is a more effective scumbag warmongering piece of shit than Nikki Haley could ever hope to be. So Trump came in as the peace president. Once Trump showed that I'll talk about peace but still bomb the fuck out of everything, well, all of a sudden, the warmongering GOP rhino pieces of shit like Lindsey Graham decide, hey, we can play ball with this king. That's why. If Trump was living up to his pledge of peace through strength rather than the application of strength to beat the shit out of people to create a pseudo-peace, Lindsey Graham would still be saying the same shit. That's why, because nothing is better for this entire corporate machine apparatus that Israel is mostly at the helm of than war. They make their money with war. They control the world with war. Soft power is more effective when hard power appears to be used judiciously. Because now the carrot and the stick is much more effective when you really believe the stick might come down on your head. I'm not saying that that's a good thing. I'm saying that's how they look at it. That's how they look at it. The United States has so much going for it that all we really have to do is worry about our own space, and we would be just fine. But that would bring far too much peace in the world. And it would also create, well, then there'll be a vacuum. No, then people could do all the stupid shit they want, and we would see what works and what doesn't. Just like the world would become a macrocosm of the microcosm that's what the United States is supposed to be, which is 50 liberties of liberty. Let's create as much liberty under the federal umbrella as possible, and let the states then take it from there, and if they go too far and they fuck shit up, people will go to other places. That's how. But we can't do that because that's not how this country's run. So, what's the takeaway from all this? None of this shit is new. None of this shit's going to change, but nothing affects your life more than you. So you can look at all of this stuff for awareness, but if you dedicate your life to trying to change this, you might as well go try to push a boulder. Push a boulder and never drink or eat anything. You'll die pushing. Anyway, moving on. Let's talk about something you can do. Did you know that there's a tree called shagbark hickory? It's a funky looking little tree. I remember the first time I learned about what it was, and I was probably about 6 years old, and we were out I was with some of my uncles and stuff and their buddies, and we came by one. I said, look at the shag bark. And I remember my uncle laughing and goes, see, he knows. He knows. It's just a tree. Did you know you can make something delicious with it? Really delicious? You've heard of maple syrup? What about shag bark syrup? It's not the same process. It's not the same thing, but I've had it. And you got to do it with moderation because it's pure sugar, but it's really, really good. Nicole Sauce will tell you how to make it.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast with an expert segment for you that is an add-on to one you got from Carrie Brown. And it goes back to December, but he was talking about shag bark hickory syrup, but he didn't say how to make it. And then he said you needed to reach out to Andy. Well, I have story time for you. So way back when I was a baby podcaster, I was also running a newspaper called the Center Hill Sun. And we did reporting on different local recreational things, politics that affected the area, that sort of thing. And one of the feature articles we did was on a shag bark hickory tree, right? So it's a tree. It grows in our area in the southeast. They live 200 years. They're a great source for lumber and for wood for smoking your meats. And we all love smoked meat, right? But as a result of that article happening, I did a bunch of research on the culinary and herbal uses for shagbark hickory. And one of the things that I found was like, it was just minorly referenced this in a folk sort of article about shagbark hickory syrup. And so I read this recipe, and it was an old-timey recipe, and I tried it. And it was delicious, and so I produced it as a recipe of the week for my podcast, talked about it on the podcast, and Andy heard that. And he reached out to me, and he was like, hey, Nicole, I've been looking for this recipe. When I was a kid, we had it, and I just didn't know how to make it. And thank you, because now I know how to make it. And from that day forward, we became friends over time, and we are friends to this day. It's too late to get tickets for my spring workshop at this point, unless you sign up for the waiting list and somebody cancels. But he'll be there. He's been there for years, and really fun guy who figures out how to do wildcrafted stuff. And that was one that we sort of became friends over. It's kind of fun how running a podcast does that over time. You meet really cool people you wouldn't have come across before. But the shagbark hickory syrup is delicious, but basically what you're looking at is infused simple syrup. That's what you're actually doing. You're using a sweetener that's separate from the tree. And here's how you make it. The shagbark hickory is a tree that's, from a sustainability standpoint, very cool because it's constantly sloughing off its outer bark, hence the name shagbark hickory, because you'll see pieces hanging off of it. And that means that you don't have to cut the tree down or harm it to get the bark. You just pull the pieces off that are going to break off anyway. And inspect them for bugs or whatever and get all that stuff off there. And then you take the bark and you put it on a cookie sheet. So I just do about a cookie sheet's worth of bark. And then I preheat my oven to 350 degrees. And I put it in there for 20 to 30 minutes until it smells a little smoky. And then I pull it back out and I take those pieces of bark and I put them in my stock pot and I'll put like, I don't know, a gallon of water or so in there and simmer it for about a half an hour. And what that's doing is it's pulling all that smoky hickory flavor out of those chips of wood. Once that is done, I take it and strain out the wood parts and just have the water. And then from there, you're making simple syrup. So I go 1-to-1 or so with water and sugar and heat that up again and then simmer it until it's the consistency you want. So you're reducing the water content until it's a syrup consistency. And then you can just bottle it and use it. Some people can it, you know, like a 5-minute seal on that. You're talking sugar water. The only thing that'll happen if you have not gotten enough moisture out and you can it and you seal it, is you will blow up your cans because what will happen is it will start fermenting and then making alcohol. And that's a whole different chapter or type of thing. But if you do that in a sealed container, that's not great. So I would probably water bath it for 15 minutes to be safe to make sure I don't trigger have anything left alive in there. But at the same time, I find no reason to actually need to can it, to seal it. I I just throw it in jars, throw them in the fridge, and then use it as I want to use it. So it's really good on pancakes and biscuits and all sorts of things that you would put maple syrup on. But also if you're a cocktail drinking person and you use simple syrup, the shagbark hickory syrup instead of simple syrup adds a smoky hickory flavor that's pretty delicious, especially in whiskey or bourbon type of beverages. And then you can use it for flavoring, I don't know, sweets and desserts. So if you're going to put a liquid sort of sweetener in something like, I can't think of the word right now, molasses. Molasses is the word. Anyway, if you're going to do molasses in something, you can substitute syrups for that. And then if you're like an advanced baker who knows how to use maple syrup for something instead of sugar, which increases your liquid content, the shagbark hickory syrup is really good for that and makes great gifts at Christmas time. All around, 10 out of 10 do recommend that for a syrup if you're going to get into something sweet. And I just love the fact that you can go into your woods and you find the shaggy hickory tree and you pull off some bark and you're done. And then the next year you go back to that same tree and there's other shaggy parts to pull off and it's done. So I hope you find that as a fun little additive. If you do get into making some shagbark hickory, let me know what you did with it. I'm very curious. Anyway, if you want to find out more about me, check it out. I've got a podcast, livingfreeintennessee.com, and I also roast delicious coffee, and we have some pretty cool infusion spoons that we just released. So you can put this, you know, like Mississippi mudslide infusion spoon in your coffee, and it is sweet, and it infuses some delicious flavors. Check that out at hollerroast.com. Make it a great week.
You know, Nicole lives in Tennessee, and Tennessee is right in the heart of Appalachia. And I want to tell you that it's really the Appalachian traditions that you can look at. And that's one of those things we talk about way more holistically than it is. Where I grew up in the coal region of Pennsylvania, it's the Appalachian Mountains. And, you know, all the way down into parts of freaking Missouri and Arkansas is really still the Appalachian Range. And it's all Appalachia, but it's not all the same. I promise you, you know, when we talk about that, and we're talking about like West Virginia and Tennessee, we're talking about a different culture than, you know, up into central Pennsylvania. And we're talking about a different culture from what is south of there in the same range of these hills that we call mountains, right? In the words of a Dan Seals song, right? Meet me in Montana, stuck here in these hills that they call mountains. Because at some levels, a lot of them that we call mountains really are hills, geographically speaking, about or geography-wise speaking on height. Don't tell me that, though, when I'm climbing up the middle of one for the third time on a given day. But anyway, there's a reason for it. And the commonality of that very broad area with multiple cultures and subcultures in it is that it was always people who, I'm not going to say were always necessarily poor, but they were never rich, maybe is another way to put it. None of them are rich. And when you're in that situation, and there are also people that tended to have a lot of kids, at least back in the day, because everybody did. So when you're in that situation, and what you are surrounded by is incredible diversity, and not the way that the retards talk about it today, right? Diversity for the sake of diversity. I mean biological diversity. I mean, you go in the woods 3 weeks apart in that part of the country, all of it, starting about right now and keep doing it every 3 weeks all the way until fall. And it's like a different, if you know what you're looking for, a different shopping experience every time you go in. From mushrooms to things like the best time of year to pull bark off a shagbark hickory, to when the ramps come in, right, the wild ramps, which are more like leeks than actual onions, to when the ferns start popping up and you can go in and harvest them like little fiddleheads, like asparagus, to when, you know, bay pops pop up, to like much different, like I said, mushrooms. You got spring, summer, and fall mushroom seasons that have different mushrooms that show up. There's so much there. And when you don't have a lot, but you have a big family, you start looking around and you do something that very much is in tune with modern survivalism. If I put this, that, and this together and take this very inexpensive thing that I do have to buy and add it to it, what can I do with it? And it's, you know, it's not that region is not the only region like that. You want another region like that? Central Louisiana. All the way down from Coonass to Cajun and back. You grow up in the Florida swamps where I grew up in as a kid. Hey, that thing there, that thing that hops around, I wonder what that would taste like if I ate it. Now, there's not much here, but these legs, they got, I'm talking about frogs. Or that little thing in the mud there looks a lot like a little lobster. And some of this stuff has become iconic food all over the world. And I'm just wondering, as I was listening to Cole do that segment, do maybe I need to do a show or two or a series on this type of thing. Foods that have their genesis, even if they've never become, like, you're not going to go to a diner, right? Like let's say something that's a name brand, like a Cracker Barrel, and they're going to say, would you like the fake maple syrup that they serve now, right? They used to serve real maple syrup. Or would you like Shagbark hickory syrup? You're not going to find that. You're not going to go to a restaurant in California unless it's some kind of chic little cool hippie thing and see shagbark hickory as an ingredient, right? Maybe you'll see it in, like, you know, North Carolina around Asheville or something in a restaurant or two, but it's going to be niche and boutique. It's not broad. So there's that type. But then there's the stuff that has become extremely broad, widespread, adopted by society as a whole, but it still comes from these humble roots. Here's another one, and then we're going to move on. Shrimp and grits. Shrimp and grits. I went last weekend. My wife and I went with two of our friends, a married couple, and went to a place called Fix, F-I-X-E. And if you're ever at a place where you can go to a Fix and you're willing to spend the money, because this is upscale, go there for like a Sunday brunch. Oh, my God, it's beautiful. The food is beautiful. The service is great. Everything's awesome. There's only two or three of them around. But, you know, one of the things they had on the menu was shrimp and grits. And Buddy David's like, I was thinking about getting that. And they have this crawfish lobster pie that is just to die for. I'm like, you know, you can. But we can get fish and grits, really good fish and grits, all over the place. Down in Fort Worth, you got Little Red Wasp, you got Riata. Like, all these places you can get shrimp and grits that are just really upscale, really great. Where else you can get that pie? He goes, damn it, you're right. So we both got the pie. Neither one of us regretted it. But shrimp and grits. Shrimp and grits. You know, when I was a kid in Florida, you know who ate shrimp and grits a lot? Poor people. I had friends that were, I thought we were poor, but they were poor. And they were always eating shrimp and grits or fish and grits. You know, shrimp, that's pretty high dollar for poor. Today, if you're buying the cheapest shrimp you can get, it's still pretty damn cheap if you're mixing it with grits to feed a family. But I'm going to say something else. When I lived in Jacksonville, Florida back then, you go to Walmart, or a Walmart, nobody went to Walmart, you go to Kmart, okay, and you could buy a 5-6 foot cast net for about $8. And there were times of the year that literally any place where an inlet came through and, you know, like a little creek flowed underneath an overpass or something, an underpass or something like that, you just go in there and you just catch all the shrimp you want. You drive to the other side of town, you pass four or five dudes on the side of the road with a pickup truck and a cooler in the back selling shrimp alive, fresh caught alive shrimp for, like, I remember back then, maybe $1.50 a pound. Dollar head on and all, but still $1.50 a pound, even in the 80s. So it was super cheap. And then what happened is grandmas and moms and aunties and stuff figured out, how do we amp this up? This seems like something we need to go down. Maybe I need to do this with Ken Daniels. What do y'all think? Let me know what you think about that. And I had no plans of talking about this 5 minutes before I started Nicole's segment. This all came up listening to her. Thank you, Nicole. Next up, let's talk with Nick Ferguson about fodder. And in this case, how do I use it? How do I manage it? How do I store it so it's available to my animals when I need it? Nick, let's go ahead and take it away.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with another expert counsel for you guys. But a quick note, we're expecting baby number 4 any day now. So if I'm not quick to respond to emails, that's why. I might be catching a baby. Now, for Chris and Andrew's questions on fodder treats, today I've got a twofer for you. All right, Andrew's question. Question for Nick Ferguson. I noticed lacebark elms are no longer part of the fodder tree package. Is this tree no longer recommended? Are lacebark elms safe to plant within 5 feet of foundation to shade structure? If not, what's recommended? I'm in the DFW area. And then Chris asks, how do I handle and store tree fodder? I love the idea of tree hay, and I have a lot of mulberry trees planted, but they are too small for much surplus, but I'm looking forward. I'm curious how I should store the surplus in a way that is as convenient as hay. Great questions, guys. I'm first going to answer Andrew's question. It's not part of this year's tree package, because what I wanted to do was provide everyone that had already purchased trees an option that was going to be really nice and convenient for expanding what you've already purchased. So I buffed up the white mulberry, and I still added some hybrid willow to the mix because I know some people have not purchased them. So I took them out so that I could add more white mulberry. But about the lacebark, it is definitely still on my recommendation list for numerous reasons. I'm not going to get into all of them. However, you're specifically asking about planting trees within 5 feet of foundations. I honestly don't like any trees planted that close to a structure, because no matter what kind of tree it is, you're going to have some root heaving. I'm planning to use lacebark elm to plant near my future build in Texas, but I'm not going to be planting them 5 feet away. I'm honestly not going to plant anything like that closer than about 12 feet away from any foundation. I've seen them planted closer, but maybe I'm just cautious. All I can tell you is what I plan on doing, and encourage you to do your own research into something that significant. I've never seen a lacebark do any heaving of even something as simple as a sidewalk. So my gut impression is they're probably safe to plant 5 feet away, and they shouldn't be a problem. But, you know, I've not seen many of those elms much older than 20 years old, so who knows what they'll be like towards the end of their lifespan. You could end up with some heaving. I don't know for sure, so I'm cautious about giving, like, my opinion and my, you know, ascribing any kind of expert status to this kind of an answer, because I just don't know for sure. So what I can do is tell you what I'm doing. I'm putting mine about 12 feet away simply because they just don't need to be closer. They'll have a canopy at about around 30 feet in diameter. So why push closer to the house? You're just going to end up with branches rubbing on the structure, or pruning that you're going to have to do. You're going to have to prune anyways at 12 feet away. So why push it any closer? I don't see any benefit to it. Maybe a little bit of shade faster, but you're getting into more maintenance and more issues down the road. So I'm just not going to do it any closer than 12 feet. So if I were you, I'd probably stick with the same kind of thing that I'm doing. Next up is the question from Chris. How should I store the surplus in a way that's as convenient as hay? Well, I'm just going to answer the question quickly and then give you some details. It's pretty simple. You cut the branches, you hang it to dry in the shade, and then you bundle the dried branches. That's the easiest. Really, it all depends on the types of critters that you're feeding. I like pellets when you put them through a hammer mill and pelletizer. That's really convenient. That's more convenient than hay. Just the old-fashioned tree hay, straight from the branch like I described first, is the simplest and easiest. If you're feeding things like goats and sheep, they're not going to have any problem with that. You're just going to have branches you're going to have to clean up. Even cows and pigs and things like that will pick off the leaves. They're just not going to get as much efficiency out of it. They're going to waste some. Cows have big tongues, and they're just not going to be as efficient at stripping those leaves as things like goats and sheep. The goats and sheep have very ductile lips, you know, very nimble and agile lips, and they can literally grab the leaves and pick them clean. But for the animals like the cows and pigs, it's generally better to strip the leaves while they're fresh, shred them, and ferment them as silage. Then you're going to have a fermented, kind of denser packed leaf product that is going to be easier for critters like cows and pigs to just get in their mouths and chew them up. As for the trees being too small for very much surplus, man, I always encourage everyone, give those trees a few years to get established and build a good root system before you ever even start harvesting. You can, while they're growing and younger and smaller, you can, but I don't think you should. You're going to end up far ahead of the game if you let them get good foundations under them and let them get really good and established. If you harvest too soon or too frequently, it is definitely going to stunt the growth and can even kill the trees if you're doing it, you know, overboard. So let them get established and wait for them to develop a stump at least the size of a rake handle before you do any cutting on it. If you let them get to a shovel handle diameter, that's even better. So great question, guys. For everyone in the TSP audience, send in your homesteading, propagation, permaculture questions, and check out my fodder trees, bacon trees, fruits. We got strawberries. I've got fantastic oak bundles over at rareplantstore.com. And all proceeds go to buying diapers for the new little girl joining our family. I'm Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and rareplantstore.com. Do good things.
Well, that one caught me off guard a little bit. I had him pre-screen it, and I didn't realize that he had combined another question. So we led off with the lace bark elm thing and switched over to the part that I realized that this one was about. So good on you, Nick, getting a twofer in under 7 minutes. That's an example for other members of the expert council. Well done, sir. I do want to remind you guys, he's got his plant sale going on. He kind of mentioned it there at rareplantstore.com. Get over there and look at the packages he has. Whether if you're like, but I know he does fodder and I don't want to fodder. He's got other stuff. He's not got a huge catalog. There's not 175,000 different species of plants, but he's got some really good stuff. And the pricing, I broke it down for you guys last week. The pricing, you can't beat it. Now, if you go buy 1,000 of one kind of tree, yes, you can beat it. If you want to buy like three of these, and three of those, you can't touch the pricing he's put together. And that's because he sells his stuff instead of one off here and one off there in these packages. And that makes everything really efficient. So go check it out, rareplantstore.com. I know it's February, like I got plenty of time to get orders in and get things planted this year. No, you don't. Tick tock. Go to Rare Plant Store. Tick tock. The clock is going to get you if you don't. Next up, Brian Steve is going to give some follow up to some questions discussion we had a couple weeks ago on water. It started out with Matt Powers, of all people, asking a question about redundancy for power to a well using solar. Ryan gave a great answer, and I followed that up with other ways to skin the same cat that had nothing to do with solar. And that was things like using water tanks and gravity feed and stuff like that. Ryan heard that and said, shit, I would have talked about that stuff too, but I only get 7 minutes. So now he's going to add on to it. And again, I love this. I want more of this, these ongoing long-term discussions. What I'd love our council stuff to turn into is kind of like, you know how there's a lot of TV shows that are kind of one-off weekly shows? In other words, you could tune into an episode of the whatever show it is, and it starts and it ends, and it's neatly wrapped in a package, and that whole episode was about, like if it's a cop show, this one bad guy, and at the end of it, he's caught and he's in jail. Right, life doesn't work that way, but TV is enjoyable that way. And at the same time, you have other TV shows that are like this. Like if you tune in to the middle of a season, you have no idea what the hell is going on. Your understanding is predicated on the last three episodes at least. And you'd never want to start a show like that if it's like a 5-year series. In year three, you'd be lost from the get-go. That kind of show. And then there's hybrids, where they have like these. You know, just like the first one, it's open and cut, and every episode's like that. But then there's like some overarching story in it that's longer term. How cool would it be if we could get enough going on with the expert camp panel that it became like that? Like we have like one or two at any given time of these long-term back-and-forth discussions before we kind of wear them out. And at the same time, we have all these other things like we've heard today so far. It's just like, hey, what about this? Oh, here's an answer. I think that would be cool. Anyway, with that in mind, let's hear from Ryan Steva, and I'll stop blabbering.
Hey, TSP community. This is Ryan Steva from the homesteadconsultant.com. I'm sitting here at my desk doing an impromptu expert council segment because I just listened to the last one that I did for sizing a solar system for pumping from a well. And Jack had some follow-up that was actually something I really wanted to talk about anyways and would have loved to cover in that segment had I had time. So I'm just doing another segment. I hope that's okay with everybody. So first of all, some of the things Jack talked about, like water as a battery or a water tank as a battery, is a really important concept to kind of wrap your brain around. And of course, it's actually pretty simple and intuitive if you think of what that represents or what represents the idea of a water battery, and that's a water tower. So all of us know what a water tower is. You pump water up to a high up point, and basically that creates pressure below it at about 0.43 PSI per foot of elevation that tank is at. That's how many PSI you can get. So you can do a quick, easy calculation. So if the tank was, let's say, at 100 feet above the area it's being used, then you would have 43 PSI of pressure, as, you know, basic calculations. That is a really important concept. And to be able to take that concept and understand how it applies to other things is really important too. But I'd like to talk about a couple of places or projects where I've installed something like this and how well it works. There's a project where I've installed is a 2,500-gallon black poly tank, which I really like using because I can get the exact same one from pretty much any Lowe's, meaning that if I needed a second one for the same location, I could get an exactly identical tank that I can match together. This project, we had a 2,500-gallon water tank. It was about 60 feet vertically above where the home would be, but it was on a hill, so it was about 300 feet away, 60 feet up. So it was a pretty steep hill. And we had a direct solar well pump, and the well was actually below the house. So it was about 70 feet up vertically that we had to pump the water from the well. And one of these direct solar well pumps did that really, really well. And of course, if we don't have sun for a few days and that pump doesn't run, it's totally fine because 2,500 gallons will keep that family going for quite a long time. The other thing that Jack mentioned that's really important to think about is if you're using solar to power something, rather than just powering that thing, it would make sense to size it just a tiny bit bigger and put it, instead of in the pump house with the pump, to put it back up at the main house. And what we can do now is we can run it's called a critical load solar system. And you basically set up a sub panel in the home that your solar runs, and it's going to run your critical infrastructure, things like water pumps, refrigerators, freezers, lights in the house, things like that. So anything that's really important to you, maybe it's internet connection, all of those things can be run off of this. And so the way I think about it is, if there's something that I would want to run on a generator, I would want to size my critical load system to run that. And then, so I can size my solar system to run those things. Typically, it doesn't need to be much, if any, bigger than what I needed for running a well pump, because a well pump's pretty intensive. And so by just sizing it slightly different and doing the calculations slightly different, I can now put it in the house instead of in the pump house. And I can run other things that are extremely important to me off of that system. And now in a long-term outage, I can top batteries off quickly with a large generator or a little bit slower with a small generator, but I can use a lot less gas because most of my power is coming from solar. And these systems can be tied to grid, meaning not that they're sending power back to the grid, but if their batteries get too low, you can have it plugged in so it tops up. So you use it just like you would a fully on-grid system, but if the grid goes down, you have something backing you up. And then if you have to, you can use a generator to top off the batteries. Now, on the topic of a generator with this system, you can also set up the generator if you've got a tank at the top of the hill and you're using one of these direct solar water pumps or even just a regular water pump like Matt had, where you just plug it into the wall. You could run that off of the generator, but you're running it up to a tank. So now you're taking good old fossil fuel and you're using the energy to spin the pump to push water uphill to create a storage of the water uphill, which is now potential energy. So you've taken that fossil fuel that's one type of potential energy, you've made it into another type of potential energy. And yes, you've lost some energy in the meantime, but you have that large battery of potential energy of water being stored up there. So it can really benefit you and it can benefit your homestead. One of the really cool things that I've noticed about the water tower systems that I've put in for people is that even with lower pressure than you would typically want in a home, let's say it's 25 PSI because of the tanks at 60 feet, I've noticed that it feels much more like higher pressure coming from like a municipality, because if you put in the right size pipe and have the appropriate flow, like an inch and a quarter pipe, you really have a lot less drop in pressure because the pipe is sized appropriately. And so it feels more like 45 PSI as compared to 25 PSI. It's just a interesting thing I've come across in putting these systems in. I think that's most of what I had to add to what Jack said, which, you know, he covered some of that anyways, but just something to think about, because again, it really comes down to how we think about problems and how we tie systems together to become more resilient. So hopefully these few different ideas help people start thinking about how do you tie systems together? How do you do something you needed to do anyways, and with a tiny bit of extra effort, give yourself a huge amount more headroom? So that's it for me. Guys, have a great week. Go do something amazing and go get your hands dirty.
Great stuff. And if you're a council member and you're out there and like, I got stuff to add to this discussion, send it on in. You don't always have to get a question from the audience for me. And that's something else. Expert panel members, if you're listening today, man, if you ain't got a question in a while, make something up. Send it on in. People want to hear from you. And the more they hear from you, the more questions you'll get. I always tell the expert panel this behind the scenes. It's just like when I was in basic training. We had a drill sergeant named Drill Sergeant Avery. I'm sorry, Drill Sergeant Irvy. Anyway, Drill Sergeant Irvy used to tell us, men, if you want mail, send mail. So what you'll notice is the expert panel members who get the most questions are also the ones who are on the air the most. And it's not one causes the other from the front, it's from the rear. The more you hear them, the more you remember they're around, and the more it makes you think, and the more you come up with questions for them. So keep those responses coming. No piking. I'll shake the piker tree once or twice, and then pikers get the ejection button. Next up, though, we got a question for Jesse Markowicz on passkeys versus passwords.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowicz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Today I have a question from Joy. Joy asks, a lot of websites are now prompting me to create a passkey. What is a passkey? Is it better than a password? Should I use it instead of a password? Great questions. The tech industry is trying to improve on passwords and make your logons more secure. Passkeys are one way to do that. Let's start with the basics. A password is a secret you know and type in. When a website asks you to log in with a password, it's basically saying, prove you're you. Send me the secret. You send the secret, the password, the website confirms it and lets you in. The secret stays the same and is sent every time you log in. A passkey is different. A passkey is not a word or a phrase that you type. It uses public key cryptography. You create a key pair, a private key and a public key. The public key gets stored by the website. The private key stays on your device, your phone, your computer, your tablet, or a hardware security key, depending upon how you set it up. With public key cryptography, the holder of the public key doesn't know your private key, but they can verify that a message is properly signed by the private key. Here's the core idea. With passkeys, your private key never leaves your device. Instead of you sending your actual secret, your password, to the website, the website sends a one-time challenge. Your device signs that challenge using your private key and sends the signed version back to the website, where the website checks the signature using the public key it already has for your account. If things check out, you're in. So what goes over the wire is not your secret. It's a signed response to a one-time challenge. And all this complexity is handled automatically by the website, your browser, and your device. Now, once you're authenticated, what happens next looks very similar to what happens with passwords. The website will create a session, usually by giving your browser a session cookie or a token. That's what keeps you logged in as you're clicking around. So passkeys mostly change the logon step, not the whole relationship between your browser and the website. So are passkeys better than passwords? In almost all cases, yes. Passkeys are phishing resistant in a way that passwords aren't. If you type a password into a fake site, you've handed an attacker a reusable secret. With passkeys, you're not sending the secret at all. You're approving a one-time cryptographic response that's tied to the real site's domain. That means a lookalike site can't capture something it can later replay the way it can with a password. Passkeys also remove the password reuse temptation. When a password database leaks, attackers try the same email password everywhere. Passkeys don't work that way because each credential is scoped to a particular site and isn't reusable across unrelated sites. Passkeys don't make you invincible, but they do improve in a number of areas. So if the website supports passkeys and your browser and operating system support them also, passkeys are generally the right answer. Diving a little bit deeper on this, just like it's important to protect your passwords, it's also important to protect your passkeys. For most people, when a website prompts create a passkey and you hit yes, that passkey is going to get stored in the operating system's built-in system. That built-in approach is convenient because on a phone, it could use Face ID or fingerprint or device PIN to approve logons. Other devices are similar. Convenience is why passkeys are gaining this adoption. Most people never buy special hardware. They're not going to do special programs. They're just going to click create passkey and it'll land in whatever the device already uses for security. So what do you need to be aware of? First, device loss and recovery. If your passkey exists only on one device and that device gets lost, damaged, or wiped, you could be locked out unless you have a backup method. Some ecosystems sync passkeys across your devices automatically. Some password managers can sync passkeys. Some websites allow multiple passkeys per account so you can register backup devices. And many sites still keep a fallback logon method, password, email-based recovery, or something like that. But you shouldn't assume that that website recovery process is going to be painless. It might be. It might not be. If it's an important account, you don't want to discover that recovery process for the first time when you're stressed out because you just lost your phone. The second thing to be aware of is theft and device compromise. If someone steals your phone and they can unlock it, either because your PIN is weak, they shoulder surfed your PIN, they pressure you, or they just get lucky, then they may be able to use those passkeys that your phone can see. It doesn't mean that passkeys are bad. If you stored your password in your device, it'd be the same thing. It does mean that your security boundary becomes, can you unlock the device? It's the same reason you don't want a trivial phone PIN. Your phone isn't just a phone anymore. It's also your wallet, your identity, your key ring. So where you store your passkeys matters. And just as a quick aside, it's the same thing for passwords. Where you store your passwords matters as well. If you store your passkeys in the operating system's built-in passkey system, which is generally the default, it's generally the most convenient. The flow is super smooth. You try to log in. The system, the device will prompt you for Face ID, fingerprint, PIN, whatever the local piece is. And that's fine. It's perfect for most accounts where the convenience matters more than maximum security. You could also use a password manager that supports passkeys. This adds a second barrier. You unlock your device to get to your password manager, and then you also have to unlock the password manager. It's one more step for you, a little bit less convenient, but it's also one more step for anyone who gets into your device. For a lot of people, this is a good compromise. There are also hardware security keys, things like YubiKey, Solo keys, and similar. These are small physical devices that can do this cryptographic signing inside the device. The private keys are specifically designed to be non-extractable. Basically, someone can't easily copy the security key. They'd have to actually take the device from you to use it. This keeps your secret, your passkey, off of your primary device. But now this new dedicated physical device, this hardware key, becomes the item you have to protect. Many of these hardware keys can also be protected with a PIN or biometric check. Hardware security keys give you better protection, but add an extra expense and more steps for you to use on a normal basis. So here's the practical advice I give to Joy and everyone listening. Think about how bad it would be for each of your accounts if they were hacked. Is it no big deal? Is it a pain in the neck? Or is it something critical to your finances and possibly your reputation? Protect each account appropriately for its importance. If something's really important to you and it offers multi-factor authentication, consider setting that up also. If you aren't ready to put higher protections on right now, at least be aware of the risk. Start planning to better protect the most important accounts one at a time. And use passkeys where they're available instead of passwords. One final note. Security is your responsibility. If your password's on a sticky note or in a notebook or on your phone or a password manager, wherever it is, be aware of how it might be compromised and take steps to minimize that risk, especially for your most important accounts. For Joy and everyone else out there, that's the key takeaway. Passkeys help, but they don't fix everything. It's up to you to protect where your passkeys and passwords are stored. This is Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Thanks for the question. Keep them coming. I look forward to answering more questions soon.
All right, now from the technical to the dogmatical, right? We're going to talk about dogs now with Joe Riles. And what we got here is a person with a dog that's generally well-behaved, but sometimes not. And now they have a new variable, a variable being a new baby. And they want to make sure something terrible doesn't happen. And it's a responsible question to ask. Let's see how Joel handles it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again with another expert counsel segment. And today's question is actually from Melody over at Noster. And she is basically asking a question about bringing a baby home with a dog that is having some kind of behavioral issue. So the behavioral issues are described as he's very well-behaved, he follows obedience, but then kind of randomly, as far as they're concerned, he'll get aggressive with puppies, bunnies, things like that. And so, of course, because of that behavior, they're concerned with bringing a baby into the house. So what this sounds like to me is a classic example of my dog is well-mannered most of the time, but I have zero obedience or control over my dog because when they decide to not be well-mannered, I can't do anything about it. All right, so let's start talking some hard truths about dog training. If you have any situations like this, where your dog is mostly acts the way that you want them to, kind of their general personality and things like that works really well in your family, and then all of a sudden out of the blue they do something totally crazy, you're out of control, and it just really bugs you, right? It doesn't have to be destructive necessarily, but sometimes it can be. It could have some kind of aggression issue to it, but it can be other obedience problems as well. What this actually means is you don't have any obedience. Your dog just simply has a personality that matches most of the time with what you want. But if you can't immediately take control of your dog, you do not have obedience in your dog. If you tell it to sit, and most of the time it does, but when it sees a deer, it goes off and chases a deer, you don't have obedience in your dog. So how do we develop obedience in our dogs so that the issue is most of the time it's not critical, right? But what is essentially happening here is when it is critical, she loses control. So how do we make sure that in those critical, important moments, we have control over our dogs? Well, there's only one way to really do that with a dog, and it's you have to make the dogs do things they don't want to do on your command so that when you need them to do it, they will stop and do it. This doesn't mean that you always have to be making them do things they don't want to do, but you should be able to put your dog in a place and walk away for an hour and come back and they're still in their place. Now, you're not going to get there immediately, but if you can't do that with your dog, then in a moment of high stress, in a moment where something goes wrong or everything goes wrong and everything falls apart and your dog does something crazy out of control and maybe causes injury or injury to themselves or damage to property or just annoys the crap out of you, that's your fault for not training your dog to behave properly. All right? So how do we go about this? Well, of course, there's Canine Academy. I recommend you guys do that if you want real obedience and control over your dogs. But let's just kind of break it down into simple steps. Number one is we have to introduce the commands to our dogs, and these commands are commands. They're not suggestions. I'm not asking my dog to sit. I'm commanding my dog to sit. I'm not asking my dog to lay down. I'm commanding my dog to lay down. Now, in our society today, a lot of people have issues with this. Oh, I don't want them to have to do anything they don't want to. Well, then you're not going to have obedience or control over your dog. Again, I can give my dog a lot of freedom. I can have my dog with me all the time, which is the thing they love the most. But when I tell them to do something, they must do it. It is not an option. I am not asking. You will do what I say to do when I say to do it. Now, in order to get that with most dogs, you're going to have some kind of a correction for the dog when they misbehave. Now, that doesn't mean you have to use a heavy, harsh correction. Depending on the dog, some will require that, but most won't. Most of the time, all we have to do is be consistent and apply the commands that we're giving consistently over time. So let's have an example of the waiting in place that I used earlier, right? I can take a young pup like this little guy right here. I have a little Dutch Shepherd puppy in my lap for the audio only guys. And I can put the puppy on a table and I can show him what it means to lay down and I can tell him to wait and I'll take one or two steps away from the table and he jumps off the table. In the beginning, I'm not going to correct him for that. Probably jumping off the table and landing on the floor and doing a backflip is enough correction in itself the first couple of times, although I'm going to try and keep him from actually jumping off and hurting himself. But if he does jump off and land a little hard, well, that's kind of its own correction a little bit to begin with. But all I'm going to do is pick him back up and put him back on the table, back into a lay down position. We call that plutz. And then I'm going to praise him when he's there. Good plutz, good weight, good plutz. I'll step back forward, give him some pets. Oh, good plutz, good weight. I'll take a step back, good plutz. I'll take a step forward, pet him some more. I'll take two steps back. I'll see how far away I can get and how long I can be there before he breaks position. And each time I do this, every day I want to spend 10 to 20 minutes training with my dog. Every time I do this, I want to increase the amount of time and the amount of distance just a little bit if I can. Until I can tell them to wait, I can walk out of the room, I can come back, and they're still there. Then I can start incorporating this into everyday life. I put my dog in, say, the living room in a spot on the floor, and I tell him to lay down and wait. And I go into the kitchen, and I start making lunch or breakfast or dinner. And when I'm finished with that, I come back out and I praise him, or periodically I'm going to peek around the corner, see that he's still where he's supposed to be, and praise him for it. If in the middle of making my meal they get up, I'm just going to give them a light correction. I'm going to take them back, put them back in their spot. I say, go back to your place. I take them back over, plutz, good plutz, you wait. And I walk back and I keep doing what I'm doing. If they get up multiple times, I'm going to have to increase the correction a little bit to teach them that, hey, that's not acceptable. But most dogs, if you're consistent with this, you don't have to ramp your correction up real high. You just have to consistently put them back, have the patience to not get frustrated during this process. And over time, they'll lay there and wait as long as you need them to. Now, in this process, inevitably there are times when little things are going to happen that you're like, hey, if that had gone worse, that could have been really bad. In those situations, I want the intensity of my chastisement and probably the intensity of my correction to increase to let the dog know, hey, that was an issue that could have gone really bad. Thankfully it didn't, but you can't do that. Right? So normally when I'm training a dog, fui is our verbal correction. It means shame on you in German. And so we'll say, fui that plutz, or fui that seats. And the vocal tone that I just use is what I use 99% of the time. But in a situation where it could have hurt the dog or somebody else or something like that, I'm going to ramp that up and be like, fui it! Knock that shit off! Right? My vocal is going to go up so that the dog knows it's a little more serious. And my dog down here, he was like, whoa, am I in trouble? You're good, buddy. But I want the dog to know that was way more serious. Knock it off. You can't do that. Because if they do, you can't have this conversation with them. You just have to let them know you can't do that. Right? But in our minds, we know if you did that at the wrong time, you're going to get hit by a car, or you're going to knock something over, or you're going to hurt somebody, or you're going to get hurt. Right? And we can anticipate those situations where, okay, not everything went wrong this time, but it could have, and if it had, it would have been way worse. So I want to take those opportunities to ramp that correction up so that the dog knows, oh, this is serious. When my person tells me something, they really mean it. And then you do that through across all of your commands. You only really need 5 or 6 commands to have good basic obedience in your dog. Sit, lay down, wait, let's go, and walk at your side. And probably leave it. If you have those 6 commands, You'll be able to do most of what you want to do with your dog. All of those are covered in Canine Academy Basics course, but you have to have the right personality. You cannot feel sorry for your dog. You are taking care of your dog, and you are taking care of yourself from lawsuits and things like that and potential injury to a family member by being serious when you need to be serious and by developing discipline. And when I say discipline, there's only one way that discipline is developed, and that's through discomfort. You can have consistency, you can have like show up and do things, but discipline by definition is doing something when you don't want to. And the only way to learn that is to do things when you don't want to. And to teach it to a dog, we have to put them in positions where they don't want to, where they're uncomfortable, where they're there longer than they want to be there, in order to develop that discipline, and then we continue to build that over time until we have what's reasonable and what works in our lifestyle. So I hope that's been helpful for you. I know it's a little bit more hardcore this time, but you're bringing a baby home with a dog that has potential aggression issues. You have to take that very, very seriously. And if you have a medium to large size dog, you should take your obedience very seriously. People will sometimes say, has your dog ever bitten anyone? The only proper answer to that question is not yet. Right? If you have a medium to large sized dog, hopefully they never do bite someone errantly, but just because they have it doesn't mean it can't happen. And I've seen a lot of dog owners whose dogs are right on the verge of biting somebody they're not supposed to, and the handler is totally oblivious to it, and the handler does not have the obedience and control to handle it should something like that happen. So if you have a medium to large sized dog, I highly recommend have discipline and obedience in your dog. You don't have to use it all the time, but you're definitely going to want it if you need it. So I hope that's been helpful for you guys. Remember, if you want help training your dog, check out canineacademy.us by going to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on the banner over there on Jack's website. If you're interested in getting a dog, whether it's a puppy, a companion dog, or a fully trained protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com, click on the consultation, send us a message, and we'll get back to you. And until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
So my addition here is actually as much for Joel as everybody listening. Joel, remember what we did 2 years ago? Bro, you need to be using this marketing collateral I created for you, and you need to be not just marketing forward with it, but marketing through, meaning good marketing becomes the message that a company carries with it and all the things that it does. Think of it like, you know, we love our customers from a dry cleaner. And then you get the little hanger and it's on there. It's been so overdone it doesn't really work anymore. But you get what I mean. Like the concept is pushed all the way through to the end delivered product. And I'm talking about what Joel and I came up with, the three C's. And the reason I like to use threes in marketing and marketing into training is that people think in threes. If I say red, blue, you think white or yellow or something. You think another thing. If I say red, blue, and yellow, you probably don't. The mind balances on threes, and most things can be fully explained with three planks. Sometimes others are useful, but the core concept can be sorted to three planks. When I had Joel out here, and we did some workup on marketing for his business, we came up with the three C's of dog training. And there's not a thing about what I'm about to say it changes a thing about what he said. It's a different, a simple, memorable way to explain the same thing where we train the human more than we train the dog, okay? And the three C's are create, control, correct. And Joel, I want you to start using that all the time. You paid for it. You paid me with a dog, but you paid for it. You came here and invested a week of your life, and you paid for it, so use it. You create the, that's what he's talking about, you create the condition. You create a condition where the dog can fail, but you create it under controlled conditions where the failure is not catastrophic. And when the dog then fails, you correct the failure instantly. Then everything else about the inflection and what have you, that's all he's dead on. And I wouldn't even change it. I would just add that to it on the front end. Create, control, correct. And it actually yields the fourth C of condition, the response that you're looking for. I want to also throw one other thing at Joel for how powerful a thing can be done when you follow his methods, which I've tried to do as much as I can. Being an old dog myself, learning new things can be difficult. But one is praising the behavior, not the dog. And what I mean is if I say wait, and the dog waits like it's supposed to, and I want to reward that, good weight. Not good girl, not good bell, not good dog, good weight. Right? Shake, dog gives you his hand, good shake. Whatever the command is, when the dog executes the command, say that has been a game changer for me. It's probably the most valuable thing I've learned from him. And then when he was talking about Fooey, I want you to understand what happens when you do that right. When you do that right. It can go, especially I think with, and Belle and Lucy are my first experience owning female dogs that I've really trained. And I think they act a little different than males. Shockingly enough, male and females act differently. But they seem to feel more. And with Bellamy, if she does something I don't like, if I say Fooey, and that's off to Fooey, that's all I have to say. It's like she thinks she's in trouble for the rest of her life. She is so like, please, let me fix it. It's amazing to me how powerful that correction is. Now, you have to use the physical corrections and all to get there. But once you're there, it's amazing. And he's right. When you have that, and you go, Fooey that, boy, that snaps them harder than snapping, you know, that prong collar does with a correction. You can't do it when they're, it doesn't work that well when they're a pup, at least in my experience. But when they have matured and they have been well trained, and definitely this is the time to address that before it's critical when mom has the baby and you bring it home. So do all the things Joel said, but just repackage it. Create, control, correct. Everybody can remember that. I came up with almost 3 years ago now, and I can still remember it, right? Create, control, correct. And I realized when we did, by the way, it's what Joel does. It's what I do. We have different versions of it, but it's what every great dog trainer does. Create, control, correct. Create the condition for the failure. Control it so the failure is not catastrophic, and correct the behavior and condition the response. All right. With that, let's go ahead and do my segment. I want to talk a little bit about this. I'll put some links in the show notes for you so you can look at it. And I'm looking for input on this too. But I had a guy send me an email yesterday. I watched the video. It was very impressive. And I dug into some of this other guy's videos that led up to the final product he created. But he created two things. And one I think is useful, but there's a ton of different ways to do it. He created something called a Tremel sorter, which is basically a big ring, like a cylinder, and the cylinder is ringed with half-inch hardware cloth, and it spins. And so you throw the biochar in it, and anything that's smaller than half an inch obviously falls through, and you kind of set it at an angle, and anything that's not small enough comes out the other end, and then it can go into the next thing that I'm about to talk about. The Trammel is not really that important to what I'm talking about. It's the crusher. So what really got me with his video, he went through everything I've tried and I've heard about. And I've deep dived into biochar as deep as it can get. I have looked at dozens of ways to crush. I've even made a wood chipper work, but it also made the wood chipper not work. And the balance had to be so perfect with it that it really wasn't worth doing. And so with that in mind, when I first got this video, I'm like, oh, it'll be another thing, like a garbage disposal or some shit. So when I put it on, and he starts going through all the different ways and all the things that don't really work well with them. Yes, this works, but it's a lot of physical labor. Yes, this works, but it makes a mess. Yes, this works, but it makes sludge, right? I was like, okay, so he's been through it too. And he's actually been, this is clearly way more important to him than me, because he spent a lot of money on things that didn't work that good and what have you as well. So what he's using to crush the char is a fruit crusher. These are made for like apples, grapes, and things like that. And what they are is the step before the pulp goes into the squeezer. So you can have the best apple juicer, squeezer, grape squeezer in the world, and if you throw whole apples in there, it's not going to work. So you crush the fruit, and then you squeeze the pulp. That's how you get juice out of an apple to make cider, for instance. Well, these crushers, there's several different kinds of them, but the most common affordable ones basically have a cone-shaped box, for lack of a better word, a trapezoid. So you have like four sides and an open bottom into the crusher itself, like a funnel. I guess that's what they call it, is a funnel. but it's square. And you put the food in the top, and then you turn the crank, or you can use, some of them have motors, you can hook a motor up to them, that type of thing. And that causes these fingers that kind of interlock in the bottom to grab and crush the food. And again, if you've ever seen one of the really big, super badass junkyard ones that they like stick like a refrigerator in, it looks just like that, only smaller and nowhere near as well built. Here's why I think it's about as good as you're going to get. I do follow quite a few people in this space, and I've seen two people build machines specifically to crush biochar. These are people with full-on like metal shops at their farm or whatever. Both of them were basically some version of that design, those interlocking fingers. The limitation I see, and the guy said sometimes some stuff comes out that's not smaller than, you know, going through half inch, and I guess you can push it back through or what have you, or just say, okay, fine, some of it isn't, but most of it is. There's some gaps in there because it's not designed to get everything down to half inch minus. So because of those gaps, some of the smaller pieces are already kind of small, but not down to that size, can get by. I look at this and I think, you know what? There's probably some modifications that can be made to either eliminate or at least reduce the prevalence of that. And with that in mind, what I'm going to do today, I'm going to put some links. It'll be under my segment in the audio notes today for show, again, episode 3804. I'm sorry, 3803. I'm going to have to fix that graphic. 3803. And also, I'll put a link to Amazon with maybe a couple individual ones, but definitely I'll put like just the like search page where you see all of them. You can look through them. And by watching the video and seeing the one that I say, this is the one I'm thinking about buying, you can see which ones out of that mess of them would fit into that model. And just maybe we can start bouncing around talking about it. I look at it and like the cheapest ones are like $70, and some of the more expensive ones with a motor and all could be like $200, and none of that is out of the ballpark. But it's just kind of like, I want to figure out what the best chance of being right out of the gate is, because he doesn't even give away a brand. He's like, they're all the same, they're all the same size. Well, they're not all the same, they're not all the same size. He does mention his is a 7-liter capacity one, but when I've looked at pictures, like beyond the surface with scale, of the ones that say 4 liters, the ones that say 7 liters, they look about the same size. So I'm going to have to play with it more. I mean, I just found this yesterday. I was just looking at the actual devices to purchase today. But I think that if we're going to skin this biochar cat anytime soon, you know, if it gets to where, you know, one person in every square mile is doing biochar, the mass market will handle this. Until we get to something like that, to where there's enough volume to warrant it, this is kind of like a sausage stuffer situation. There's a lot of people that make sausage, but there's not that many of them, right? And I don't mean commercially. I mean like at a consumer level, a household level. And most people that do, they only make so much a year, so they're willing to limp by with a grinder or one of the ones that are available as a consumer level, and none of them are great, and they're all basically the same. So they're expensive, and yet they're below the quality that you really want for something that you would want to invest in long term. And it's a direct consequence of there's just not that big a market to sell it to. I'd say there's probably a hell of a lot more people making sausage than there are biochar, especially in the backyard. With that, because, I mean, it's hunters, right? But it's also like just culinary people and people that like to like barbecue. I mean, there's 100 sub niches there, and it's pretty much people that make biochars, it's one micro niche for right now. And what that means is when I look at these fruit crushers and I say to myself, how hard would it be if you were running a shop building these to modify them specifically for biochar and create a product that would cost about the same to manufacture and deliver, but would just be, you know, 2 or 3 times better for that purpose? It's not hard, but if I wanted to go down to the metal shop at the end of my road and talk to the guy that runs it and show him what I wanted and get him to custom build me one, it would probably cost me $1,000. If I said something to him like, look, man, what if I buy 10 of these a month? Maybe I get it down to $750. Now it's heavy, it's bulky, and I have to ship it. It's still a $1,000 plus product to make it worth my time And it's not, and at that point, even if I make $200 a unit, I'm making $2,000 a month to do all this shit. You see what I'm saying? If you can set up a production line on a piece of equipment like this to make 100 a day, you can, with economy of scale and ease of repetition and tooling and parts and jigs and everything else, you can probably drive the price rate down to where you can make a product deliverable for 100, 150, 200 bucks. Which I think most people in this space, if you gave them a way to easily crush biochar that worked for $200, you can sell all of them you can make until you can't sell any more because the market's not that big. So we're going to have to adapt something that's off the shelf that does something else for the time being. Now, what may be a product is if we get enough people playing with these things, if you can figure out how to improve the performance with something that you can build and deliver for 50 to 75 bucks, somewhere in that range, now I can buy this thing for 120 bucks. I can put another 70 into it. I'm still under $100. Now the guy making the add-on can make money. Would 3D printing work for this? Well, no, Jack, it's plastic and biochar. Well, it wouldn't work for fingers, but it might work for guides or something. I don't know. This is something we had an engineer on yesterday. We need engineers looking at this problem. And I think the problem up till now has been if you tell an engineer to look at the problem, he'd figure out how to build a machine from the ground up for you, and you're back to minimum $1,000 or more on a deliverable, which doesn't make sense for a backyard producer. It just doesn't. It's too much money for what it does. Right? And and again, as a product, it's an expensive product to ship and deliver and warehouse for such a small thing. Right? So I'm not going to do it. You know, like it'd be like going to a custom knife maker and they say, here's all my production knives. And what do your production knives sell for? Oh, $50 to $200. Well, I want my knife to look exactly like that one, but a little bit like that one. And I want this, I want that. How much is that going to be? $1,600. $800 deposit and I'll get it to you in a year. Why? Because he doesn't really want to do it. He'll do it, but he's going to charge where it's worth taking his time to do a one-off. That's this world in a nutshell. We have got to figure out how to use something off the shelf, either as is or with slight modification. And I think if we can do that, we can actually open the floodgates and then maybe better solutions come. Because making biochar is easy. And it's fun. And it's something anybody can do. And the only bottleneck is really the crushing. Because from there, the application is simple as shit. And that's why all the guys, because I heard from several people last week, all the guys that have large livestock, that's what they do. You know, if they have cattle and they have a laneway, they just, you know, and they bring the cattle out of the paddock into the laneway at night and then move to the next paddock the next day, they just pile shit up there with biochar in it for them to walk shit and eat. You know, people put it in their with their hogs. Like, there's all kinds of when they're rotating animals on rotational grazing, they'll put the biochar and then they graze on top of that and they crush it and bust it up and chew it and shit it. And it because it's easy. The making it is not the hard part. It's the crushing. So if we can skin that, if you're interested, shoot me an email, TSPC biochar in the subject line. And maybe we'll get some kind of a small telegram group or something going and see what we can come up with. Because I think this is starting to open it up. And if we can all come up with very inexpensive ways, if we can do what this dude did, because he used a ground auger motor as the motor on this thing, I think that could get kind of expensive. I don't know. There's a lot to look at here and unpack. And if you're interested, I'd be interested in hearing from you. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up. I appreciate everybody for tuning in today. Remember, our item of the day today is the Energizer power failure lights. And I would say, if not the Energizer ones, get some other ones. However, as I said, every version thereof I have tried has had the same problem. Fried batteries in about 2 years and no way to replace them. These, you can replace the battery. So if somebody finds a really good power failure light set, especially if they're more affordable and work just as good or better, And they also have replaceable batteries. Let me know, because I always try to recommend the best thing available at the time. These are the best that I found up to now. Again, Energizer Power Failure Lights. You can always help the show out anytime you do your shopping, starting at tspaz.com. T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Go there before you buy, and you'll help us out no matter what it is. Also, consider getting a copy of my book, Laws of Life by Jack Spirko. As I said, the second book in the series, Laws of Life 2, is finished. I'm doing one more once over through it. I'm about 80% through it. And my next step is going to be go back and write a second or fix the first edition into a second edition of the first book. But I also throw something out here. I'm interested in someone talking to me about editing this book for me. And I'm not going to say what I'll do over the air as to payment, but it will be interesting. I'll leave it at that. So if you are a pain in the ass type of person that notices every damn thing wrong with everything that anybody writes, and you have it in you to edit a book that I will warn you is 120,000 words, it is twice as long as my first book, and you'd like to make a little bit of money with a little bit of a string of money attached to it, let me know. And we'll go from there and see if we can find somebody to get it edited. Once it's edited, I know who's doing the formatting, because the Libertarian Book Designer is awesome. He did a great job on the first one for me. So I would like to get that book out into the marketplace in the next 60 to 90 days. So somebody reach out to me. With that, it's been Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month. Never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.